From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
The first immortality story is staying alive, because it's the most obvious. If you don't want to die, well, just keep going, just stay alive. So it's the idea that we can do that in this body, on this earth, forever. We want to live forever, and civilization is how we try to do that.
Hey, I'm gonna live forever. I'm gonna learn how to fly. Oh,
I am immortal.
Yeah. And so we have to create these alternate narratives. We could even say alternate endings to go with the theme of the show.
When I feel like this.
We can't really imagine not existing. We can't conceive of dying, of being dead.
Well, that ending is really, it's almost like an existentialist take on life.
Now it's over, I'm dead, and I haven't done anything that I want. Or I'm still alive, and there's nothing I want to do.
One of the most popular special bonus features on a movie DVD is the alternative ending. These endings were filmed, but scrapped in favor of the ending we actually see, the real ending. But what if our lives were like DVDs? What if we had alternative endings to look forward to, rather than the oh-so-obvious and cliched ending of death? Today, we'll explore how people have tried to conquer death and how this quest for immortality drives civilization. Also, Sean Hemingway talks about the 39 alternative endings that his grandfather, Ernest Hemingway, wrote for his classic novel, A Farewell to Arms.
And I think it's a testament, really, to my grandfather as a writer and how hard he worked at his craft to achieve perfection.
But first, how much time do you think we have left? And personally, but as a species, 20 years? 100? 1,000? Or are you optimistic that we have enough ingenuity to create an alternative ending so that humans can endure? Science journalist Annalee Newitz thinks we can do it, but it's not going to be easy. Newitz is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. And Strange Champs talks with her.
Annalee, when you talk about mass extinction, what exactly does that mean? I mean, not your everyday, ordinary cataclysm, but something very specific?
Yeah, it's actually a very slow-motion cataclysm in some ways. It's when 75% or more species on the planet go extinct in about a million years. So it's something that is very fast in geological time, but very slow from the perspective of an individual lifespan. And there have been 5 of these events on Earth over the past 500 million years or so.
Can't some of them happen fast? I mean, like the meteorite that wiped out the dinosaurs?
Actually, it's kind of a misunderstanding of how these events work that we imagine them happening really fast. Oftentimes, something like the meteorite that was partially responsible for killing off the dinosaurs, it's viewed as being this giant explosion that wrapped the Earth in fire and, you know, everybody died instantaneously. But actually what happened was, of course, there were localized deaths near the impact site. But the real damage came in the coming centuries as all of the toxins and dust that were kicked up by that meteorite strike started to change the environment. And specifically, it caused really dramatic climate fluctuations that ruined habitats for many different dinosaur species. So what you would see is initial deaths and then a slow shift in the climate. And over time, many, many more species died out. And so at the end of a million-year period, you're looking back and you're seeing about 75% of all species dying out. But that didn't happen right away.
So if this is the next mass extinction that we're already some 1,000-plus years into, how is it likely to play out, do you think?
It's probably going to be a situation where we're going to see more and more animals go extinct. And it's going to be driven probably by things like habitat destruction. So we have climate changes going on. That leads to ocean acidification. When you load the environment with carbon, that causes the ocean to become acidified. And so that ruins habitats in the ocean. And meanwhile, on land, we're seeing all kinds of ways that habitats get destroyed, everything from human development to climate change, transforming the way that plants can grow and things like that. So what you'd likely see in the long term is a lot of famine and starvation, because when environments change, what actually happens is animals don't get enough food to eat and plants don't get enough access to the kinds of temperatures they need and things like that. So likely we would see more and more die-offs as a result of habitat change. And then as more animals are dying off and as more plants are dying off, any animals and plants that depend on those creatures that have died out, well, those are going to die out too. We call that a knock-on extinction event. And my hope is that over time, we can use what we've learned from geological history and use our science and our technology, I suppose, to deal with this problem. And I say technology, I suppose, because I think that a lot of the solutions to the climate problems that we're going to be facing may not look like technology as we know it. I don't think we're going to use giant machines to solve this problem. I think we're going to have to learn how to create science and technology that behave more like part of the environment and that are not destroying the environment.
Well, let's talk about some of the particular reasons you feel optimistic. For instance, you're kind of high on the potential in algae.
I am. I love algae. Blue-green algae specifically, which is actually cyanobacteria. It was classified as algae kind of incorrectly, and now we know it's a form of bacteria.
Isn't that the stuff that grows in farm ponds that we're all supposed to avoid?
It looks like scum on top of the water. Some species of it can be a little bit toxic, but the blue-green type that's that blue-green color is just fine. You can go and pet it and have a conversation with it if you want. The thing that's great about cyanobacteria is that it's one of the world's most powerful survival species. It has survived every single mass extinction on the planet, and it's done it for two reasons. One, it's incredibly adaptable, and two, it's figured out a way to live almost anywhere on the planet by inventing something that humans have just invented really recently, which is solar power. These creatures are the very first photosynthesizers on the planet, as far as we know. Billions of years ago, they started using sunlight as a form of energy and have continued to do that. And in fact, plants evolved by using cyanobacteria and incorporating it into their cells in order to do photosynthesis themselves.
Is there a way that we humans could figure out how to tap algae's capabilities?
Yeah, there's scientists right now who are working on doing that in two ways. One would be to use technology to imitate how photosynthesis works and to create solar fuel generators. And there's a number of labs that are doing that. There's also labs that are working on using the algae itself to do things like create hydrogen fuel. So actually turning the algae into a part of a biological device. And those are both incredibly hopeful outcomes for science. And I think especially looking at how to change algae into something that we can use as a building block for solar-powered cities, for example, is a very interesting way of looking at how our technology might change in the future to be more like the natural environment. A lot of people are looking at synthetic biology as being a way of building new kinds of cities and new kinds of machines.
I've talked with other scientists who do future modeling who say that there's practically no doubt in their minds that the only way the human race is going to survive is if we colonize other planets. What do you think?
I think that we will survive even if we don't colonize other planets, but I think that we are going to want to colonize other planets. We're great explorers. I think that when humans are exploring, most often it brings out our best impulses as a species. We're very good at remaining in touch with each other over vast distances and making great discoveries and adapting to new places. And I think it's I hesitate to say natural because none of this is particularly natural, but I do think it makes sense for us to continue the kind of exploration we started when we left Africa tens of thousands of years ago and started exploring other parts of the planet. I think it's a dream for many people. It offers people hope that humans will continue to change and evolve. And I think it's a very good goal to have because I think if we set as a goal that we're going to colonize space, that's going to help us develop a lot of technologies that will help us survive on Earth, like geoengineering technologies and like technologies for living in an environmentally sustainable way, which is exactly what you would have to do in order to ride in a spaceship to another world. You would need a way to have a sustainable environment in the ship. You would need a way to geoengineer that planet to make it habitable for humans. I mean, as long as nobody else is using that planet.
A key point.
Yeah, please don't use planets that are already being used. So I think that it works well as a goal scientifically and also emotionally for people. Mm. And it's also a reminder that this isn't the final stage of Homo sapiens. We evolved from another species about 200,000 years ago. We're going to evolve into other species in the future. And if we colonize other worlds, that's going to be one way that that kind of evolution might happen. Because as we adapt to new environments, we are going to evolve and change to be better suited to those environments.
So if we're going to colonize other planets, we're going to need to do some human genetic engineering too, won't we, to change ourselves so that we can live in other places?
I think so. I think that's a very difficult idea for people to talk about right now because of all the ethical issues, which are incredibly important. But one of the ways that scientists are thinking about this is, what would it take to create a human who was more radiation resistant? Because one of the really big issues in space is that you're constantly being bombarded with radiation. And on Earth, we have a really nice magnetic field that really prevents us from getting a lot of the radiation that's just zooming through space all the time. So on the surface of the planet, we're not as much in danger. But once you're in space, you're really exposed. So there are scientists who are thinking about, well, what is it about some people that makes them able to repair their DNA when it's damaged more efficiently than other people? We suffer from DNA damage all the time. Some of it is from radiation and some of it's from other stuff. But some people's DNA repairs itself better. So maybe our first move, if we wanted to tweak humans to be more space-worthy, would be to figure out what the genetic characteristics are of people who can really repair their genes well and start trying to use gene therapy to enhance regular humans that don't necessarily have this super repair ability. When I say super repair ability, I just mean people who have a better ability to repair their genomes than others.
So we're going to create a genetically altered race of human explorers, I guess, space explorers. So I'm curious, Annalee, at the very end of the book, you pose the question, what will our post-Homo sapiens offspring remember about us? Did you answer the question? What do you think the answer is?
Well, I have a hope of what they will remember about us. And I hope what they remember is kind of like what we remember about our ancestors, Homo erectus, who invented fire and is our immediate ancestor. You know, we think of Homo erectus as being pretty awesome. I mean, I don't know if we would want to have it over for dinner or not. But, you know, Homo erectus used fire. They explored all of Africa and as well as Europe and Asia. They were really the first early humans to leave Africa. And when Homo sapiens left Africa about 80,000 years ago or so, they found the descendants of Homo erectus all over Asia. So I hope that when our future progeny look back on Homo sapiens, they say, wow, I don't know if I'd want to have them over for dinner because they were kind of dirty and, you know, they were really warlike. But, you know, it was so great that they did all that science and exploring that helped us get out here into space and exploring other worlds. And we've learned a lot since then. And we probably would never want to do what they did back in the 21st century. But they were a good good try. It was a good species, and they did a pretty good job pulling through. And I think that's what my hope is. And maybe some of our media will survive, too, and they can look back at it and laugh at our primitive video files and printed words.
And our quaint, silly ways. Annalie, thank you so much for talking today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Annalie Newitz is the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. She's also the editor of the science website io9.com. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. What do you think of Newitz's ideas about how to keep humanity going? You can share your thoughts with us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we explore our obsession with living forever as we continue our hour on alternative endings. I'm Tim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Immortality may be the most universal of all our obsessions, and it's something that Adam Leith Goldner was obsessed with enough to turn into a book. Goldner's a freelance journalist and the former editor of Vice magazine. His book is called The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever.
I noticed something in common with all of the spiritual leaders I spoke with, whether it was a Hasidic rabbi or a Jesuit priest, or a Sufi imam, or a Buddhist nun. They all had one thing in common, which was they said, you know, it's fine for you to come here and want to understand belief, but we aren't believers. We know. We know what will come after death. We know what happens to the soul. In our belief system, it's not belief, it's knowledge. And that really fascinated me. Like, I kept on seeing that over and over again. Don't these people see that there's no certainty here? But for them, there is certainty because they have faith. And what I learned from all of them is that belief is this mirage that provides the illusion of certainty. And for them, it's no longer just belief, it's certainty.
Wow. And this was true across faiths and non-faiths, too, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that nowhere do you see that more than in these supposed physical immortalists, people who have a desire to never die, for their bodies to stay physically intact until, I want to say the end of time, but even beyond the end of time, forever. And it's an interesting kind of movement because it's so scientific. It's like the most radical, futuristic, scientistic movement. But I think it's so completely a modern appropriation of this ancient mythology about eternal life, just transposed into a kind of cybernetic era.
Well, of course, you look back to the history of this, and it's a subject that has fascinated mankind for thousands of years. If you look just at recent things, though, look at all the science fiction about immortal life. Robert Heinlein wrote about it. George Bernard Shaw wrote a whole series of plays about that. We have elements in Greek mythology where it worked well or badly to be immortal. It's clear that people want to think about this.
It's clear that we're all faced with this profound question, which is, what does death mean? Why is it there? It's kind of senseless. It doesn't make any sense to us. We can't quite grasp it. Why do we have to die? Most of us accept that it's real, that we are mortal. Some of us don't. But at the same time, when we lose somebody, it's such a kind of perplexing situation. The grief can throw us into a complete, what's called a meaning threat, where things don't make sense because we can't quite compute. Like, our consciousness cannot envision a lack of consciousness. There's this bug built into the operating system where it just doesn't make sense. And so we have to create these alternate narratives, We could even say alternate endings to go with the theme of the show. But we have to have some way of envisioning what death is. We have to say either it's a complete stop, and we believe that consciousness is just something that's happening between the neurons in our brain and nothing more, or we side with the vast majority of people, which is, depending on the survey, somewhere between 75 and 95% of us who believe in life after death, and we say there is something more to come. There's some sort of person permanence out there, and some part of us, our soul or our spirit or our consciousness, lives on in some indeterminate afterlife.
One of the people you went to great lengths to talk to is someone I wasn't expecting to encounter in your book. I suspect you know who I'm talking about.
David Copperfield, master illusionist, greatest magician of our time, issued a press release a few years ago saying that he had found the Fountain of Youth on his private islands in the Bahamas. And what he said is that you can take dead insects and put them in the water and they fly away. And
wow.
you can take brown leaves and put them in the water and they become green again. And I thought, I wish I could be the reporter that goes to his private island to find out what's really going on there.
I bet you weren't the only one who really wanted to go there. What is it called, Musha Cay?
Yeah, I think Musha Cay or Musha Cay, depending on how you pronounce C-A-Y.
Okay.
Musha Cay,
I think. It's what, 11 islands? It's a little archipelago in the Bahamas?
It's a relatively large archipelago, given that he's the sole proprietor. It's a scattering of islands in this beautiful Caribbean Sea, and on one of these islands, he claims to have found a liquid that reverses genes. I don't know how many other reporters really wanted to go and track down this story. Apparently, he was pretty widely mocked for suggesting this, and everybody just said, oh, it's a scam, you know, because you can rent out these islands. You can go and stay there, and that's the idea. It costs $35,000 a night plus tax, with a minimum five-night stay.
He has some people who are willing to pay that, presumably for the possibility of finding the Fountain of Youth?
Who knows? The way he puts it is he says he's in the billionaire business. And so the only people who are going to go there are people who can spend $250,000 on a weekend getaway. And some of the people who've done that are people like the founders of Google. Sergey Brin got married there or had his honeymoon there. And I found that to be quite interesting because he's been one of the people who's really been helping finance the technological developments that may potentially lead to certain breakthroughs in longevity and anti-aging. So it's interesting. Clearly, he had a fascination with that idea.
I can imagine. Now, you must be a very persuasive man because you did, in fact, go to Musha Cay, didn't you? And you didn't pay $35,000 a night or stay 5 days to do your research.
I stayed 3 days with David Copperfield, and it was an amazing trip. The best part to me was when he agreed to have this long, hard, scrabbled interview where I asked him all the difficult questions. Part of our negotiation about this story happening was he said, you can come to the island, but I will not show you the fountain. If you think you're going to see my wrinkled hand go into a stream of water and come out young, you're crazy. And I remember he said that people would crucify him if they saw that. And I thought, what an interesting analogy to make.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't show it to me, but he would discuss it with me with, as he put it, great verbal aplomb.
So did he explain how it worked?
He said that he'd hired a team of biologists and scientists to study exactly how it's working. He said that what it is it's a liquid that reverses genes. And he said that he hasn't been able to figure out exactly what it does or how it works, but that it is not a magic trick. He made a clear distinction between what he calls puffery, meaning his stage magic and his illusions, and finding a liquid that reverses genes.
Now, he didn't show it to you. He was only willing to talk to you about it. Did he offer any evidence of its efficiency, of its efficacy?
Well, part of the reason that I did decide to go down there, even though he said he wouldn't show it to me, is I thought, well, fine, I'm going to just sneak out at night and find it. And so...
So you did. Did you sneak out?
I did, definitely.
What happened?
There was this one part of the island that was this rather eerie body of water, and it was called the Sanctuary. And I was sure that that's what it was, because it was such a strange, murky water and all these bleached, white, brittle, kind of dead trees around it. It was such an unbelievable setting. And I thought, this must be what it is. They called it the Petrified Lake also. And I thought, what is that? What is a petrified lake?
So David Copperfield really did sort of change your understanding of immortality.
Well, how about we say this? He helped me suspend my disbelief for the purposes of telling a story. I mean, he really gave me a story. I don't know if he changed my beliefs on the idea of immortality, but again, he did help me understand the meaning of belief.
Now, from the way you're talking, of course, it sounds as though you did not find the Fountain of Youth, which doesn't mean that he doesn't have it.
I wouldn't be so sure. I think you'll have to read that section and see what's there.
Now, everybody wants to think about what the future is going to be like, and some people sort of act on it, I guess. You attended a 2068 party in California. Is that what that was?
That was a party that was held by a group of physical immortalists to celebrate the supposed 125th birthday of one of their members, and it was going to take place in the year 2068. So everybody had to show up in costumes, in period garb, the way we would dress in the year 2068.
So what did you wear?
I went with some friends and we kind of wore silver bodysuits to look like members of the future so we could blend in.
Did you blend in?
I think so. I mean, everybody was crazy there, so we were just as crazy as everybody else. I think the greatest discovery there was the fact that Aubrey de Grey, one of the great proponents of what he calls ending aging, happened to come to this party. And I was so thrilled because I'd been wanting to interview him, and there we had a chance to do the interview right then and there. It was also interesting to hear these amateur hobbyists, immortalists. At one point in the party, people were able to get up in front of everybody else and talk about how we had attained immortality by the year 2068. So they all gave their stories and their versions of how humanity had accomplished this great dream.
Did you hear anything new there from them?
Well, no. It was kind of repeating the stories that we've all heard from, mainly from Ray Kurzweil and Aubrey de Grey, you know, that there's going to be a way of curing every disease that mankind has ever had, and we're going to upload our minds into computers, and we're going to have tiny nanobots patrolling our bloodstream, and we're going to get rid of our organs, and we're going to become cyborgs, and we're going to download our memories into clones all over the world wherever we want, and we're going to have perfect sex with sex bots. I mean, it's the same old story always.
Adam Leith Gollner is the author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Our obsession with anti-aging creams and plastic surgery might make you think that our lust for immortality is pretty new. But it goes back a long way to ancient Egypt and early China. In fact, author Stephen Cave thinks our efforts to cheat death by living forever are the driving force behind civilization. Cave spells out his argument in his book, Immortality. Steve Paulson talks with him.
Stephen, the subtitle of your book is The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, which is quite a provocative statement. Do you really think our obsession with immortality has shaped civilization?
Yes, I do. And all living things want to keep going, to project themselves into the future. And we humans are no different. And in fact, because we have these massive brains, we can conceive of the future extending indefinitely before us. So whereas other creatures just want to survive moment by moment, we want to live forever. And civilization is how we try to do that.
You'll have to explain that. How do we do that through civilization?
Well, think, for example, of all the material aspects of civilization. So we build buildings to give us shelter, and we have clothing to keep us warm. Agriculture puts food on the table. Medicine prevents us from falling to disease. So all of these material aspects of civilization, they really exist just to help us live longer. But of course, even though they really do help us to live longer, still death looms over us. And so we have these other aspects of civilization, these more symbolic, cultural, religious aspects like art and Christianity, that promise that even if the buildings and the agriculture and the medicine don't do it for us, still we can live on.
You approach this subject in many different fascinating ways. For instance, you talk about something you call the mortality paradox. Can you explain what this is?
The mortality paradox, it starts with the realization that at some point, some early human's brain got big enough for them to realize, oh my God, we're going to die. Presumably mice and snakes, they don't know this. They live from moment to moment. But because we can conceive of ourselves in the future, we can have this realization. All living things die. I'm a living thing. I'm going to die. And this is, of course, terrifying. And this forms one side of the mortality paradox. But on the other hand, we can't really imagine not existing. We can't conceive of dying, of being dead. It's a kind of logical impossibility. So this is the paradox. On the one hand, death seems to us inevitable and inescapable. On the other hand, it seems inconceivable and impossible. And this is a contradiction. But we don't live with this contradiction. We don't live with this paradox. We tell ourselves stories that help to resolve it.
Which suggests that it would scare a lot of people. I mean, you know, basically we know we're going to die. We can't do anything about it. We're incapable of, in some deep way, of dealing with the terror of death. But there are strategies. And you, for instance, talk about something called the terror management theory. What is that?
That's right. The terror management theory is this body of research in psychology that says, look, the basic fact that we're going to die is terrifying to us. We're not built to have to deal with this fact. And so we tell ourselves stories. We shape our worldview in ways that help us to manage the terror of death. That's why it's called terror management theory. Now, various thinkers and philosophers and people like Freud have thought this in the past, going back thousands of years. But the people, the researchers behind terror management theory, a group of American psychologists, set out to actually prove this in the lab. So, for example, they'd take a group of people. One recent study took a group of agnostics, that is, people who are kind of undecided in their religious views, and they reminded half of them they were going to die, and the other half they made to think about dental pain or something equally horrible, but not death. And then they asked them again about their religious views. Now, those who had been reminded of their mortality were afterwards twice as likely to express faith in God, even though beforehand they were all equally agnostic. So remind people of death, get them to think about mortality, and they run to Jesus. So this is evidence that our religions, for example, are strategies we have to help us deal with the fear of death. And this applies not just to religion, but the terror management theory researchers have now, in over 400 studies, shown this applies also to nationalism. So the idea that you can live on as part of your nation, or the desire for fame, for example, or even the desire to have children.
Well, let's talk about this in more detail, because you have argued that there are four basic ways that every civilization chases after immortality. Basically, we have four immortality narratives. The first one you call staying alive. What is that?
Well, that's right. I think there appears at first to be a huge diversity of different kinds of story about how we can defeat death. But actually, they all fit into four basic categories. And the first of these, the first immortality story, is, as you say, staying alive. Because it's the most obvious. If you don't want to die, well, just keep going. Just stay alive. So it's the idea that we can do that in this body, on this earth, forever. And we mentioned before that civilization is helping us to do this. I mean, life expectancy has doubled in the last couple hundred years, from just 40 to 80 in the Western world. So we're really making this happen. We really are living longer. And yet still the idea that we can stay alive forever just seems a little bit eccentric. And yet every culture in human history has some story of an elixir of life or fountain of youth or something that can help to keep us going forever.
Right. Well, then there's another solution to this, which is your third immortality narrative, and that's the soul. Okay, maybe we don't have to worry about the body living on forever, but the soul perhaps could once the body dies.
That's right. The idea of the soul neatly solves this problem for us. And we see this in the history of Christianity. Early Christians put their faith in the resurrection. They thought they'd die, and then they're properly actually dead until the moment of resurrection. But we have this problem about putting people back together. And so some Christians thought, well, hang on, if we've got a soul as well, then the soul can bridge this gap. So we're not really dead, because this fundamental part of us, the soul, is living on. And this is a hugely attractive idea, because then suddenly we're not dependent upon this messy, unreliable body, but we each have a part of us, if you like, the real me, the real you, that is by its nature immortal, that can leave the body behind. And so death, then, instead of becoming a source of anxiety, becomes liberation. It's the moment when the soul is free. And if you have that view, it's much easier to deal with the fear of mortality.
Of course, there are all kinds of philosophical problems with the soul. I mean, are we talking about our consciousness living on precisely as it was when we had a body and a brain and all of that? Does the sense of self stay together?
Well, in the West, when most people think of a soul, they think of their full personality, their consciousness and their memories and their desires and their beliefs. But the problem is, science suggests that all of those things, consciousness and memories, are dependent upon the brain. And of course, if I knock you on the head in a certain way, if a bit of your brain is destroyed, then your memories can disappear. Or other fundamental parts of you can disappear if your brain is damaged. Your capacity for love or your idea of right and wrong. And the question is, well, if these things are actually dependent upon a soul, how is it that they get knocked out when a bit of the brain's damaged? And if your memories or your capacity for right and wrong can't survive just a bit of your brain being damaged, what makes us think it can survive when your whole brain dies, like when you die? And so increasingly, people are becoming skeptical of the idea that the real me or the real you can actually just leave the body behind.
Now, we've been talking with the assumption that everyone wants immortality in one way or another, but that is not absolutely obvious. That would be such a great thing. And there are people who have questioned that. For instance, the great Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges wrote a story called The Immortal. Can you describe what happens in that story?
Yes. Borges tells this wonderful story about a soldier in ancient Rome who he's seeking the river that cleanses men of death. And he goes on this great epic quest. And eventually he comes to this sort of desert. And there are these troglodyte-like people just lying around. One of them hasn't moved for so long that a bird has nested on his chest. And he finds out eventually these are the immortals. And he finds out one of them is Homer, who wrote the Odyssey and the Iliad. And this Roman soldier says, well, what a glorious thing. Aren't you proud? And Homer says, no, don't you see? If you live forever, it is impossible not to write the Odyssey, at least once. And so the idea is if we live forever, we'll all end up doing everything. And so we all become the same person. And we all become both villain and victim and king and pauper. And after a while, all meaning breaks down, all purpose breaks down.
I mean, that is a profound idea, that somehow we need mortality to have meaning in our lives.
That's right. It's mortality that gives shape to our lives and forces us to make choices, and it's those choices that define us. If we have infinite time, we can all do everything. And so all our actions lose their meaning.
Okay. Well, you have looked at all these immortality narratives that have been floating around for eons. You suggest that maybe there's another one, that we could have a better one, what you call the wisdom narrative. Explain what that is.
So I found, looking at all these immortality stories in different cultures, different times, there have always been these quiet voices that say, well, hang on, I'm not sure I'm convinced about this immortality story. And we find these voices even in ancient Egypt, which dedicated its entire economy to the pyramids and the tombs and to mummification. Every now and again, we find a little bit of graffiti on a pyramid saying, now, hang on, all of these mummies, has anyone ever seen them come back? You know, make merry while you can. And this message we see in this recurring literature called the wisdom literature from the Near East. And that's why I call this story the wisdom narrative. I've taken that from this wisdom literature, which we find, for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest stories that we have, and in the wisdom books of the Bible, like the Psalms and Ecclesiastes, for example. And the message is always, well, look, we don't really know about this living forever business, and maybe it's not such a good idea. So let's focus on the here and now instead. Let's appreciate what we have. And that's very much the message of Ecclesiastes. And Psalm number 90 goes even further and says, learn to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. So actually learn to think about the fact that our time is limited. We have to face up to mortality in order to gain wisdom, which means in order to really appreciate the time that we have.
Stephen Cave is the author of Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever, and How It Drives Civilization. He spoke with Steve Paulson. If you could choose an alternative ending for your life, what would it be? You can share your thoughts with us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always great to hear from you. Coming up, Sean Hemingway on the 39 alternative endings that his grandfather, Ernest Hemingway, wrote for A Farewell to Arms, as we conclude our hour on alternative endings. I'm Tim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I just can't believe Nikki's teaching that book to the kids. I mean, it's the whole time. Let me just break it down for you. The whole time you're rooting for this Hemingway guy to survive the war and to be with the woman that he loves, Catherine Barkley.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Pat.
And he does. He does. He survives the war after getting blown up. He survives it. And he escapes to Switzerland with Catherine. But now Catherine's pregnant. Isn't that wonderful? She's pregnant. And they escape up into the mountains, and they're going to be happy, and they're going to be drinking wine, and they dance. They both like to dance with each other. There's scenes of them dancing, which was boring, but I liked it because they were happy. You think he ends it there? No. He writes another ending. She dies, Dad. I mean, the world's hard enough as it is, guys. Can't somebody say, hey, let's be positive? Let's have a good ending to the story?
That's a clip from the movie Silver Linings Playbook. Bradley Cooper's character isn't the only one who's had trouble with the ending to Ernest Hemingway's 1929 book A Farewell to Arms. Hemingway himself struggled with the ending to the book, which has been called the greatest novel about World War I. His grandson, Sean Hemingway, edited a new version of the book, A Farewell to Arms, the Hemingway Library Edition. The book collects all of the alternative endings. Steve Paulson talks with Sean Hemingway.
Sean, can you give us a brief summary of the storyline of A Farewell to Arms?
Certainly. A Farewell to Arms is my grandfather's classic novel about World War I. It's a love story set in northern Italy about an American who joins the Italian army as an ambulance driver and falls in love with a British nurse named Catherine Barkley. Frederick Henry, the American soldier, is wounded, and the love story progresses. Catherine gets pregnant, and Frederick has to flee Italy because he's considered a deserter, and they leave to Switzerland, where she gives birth to the child, and tragically, she and the child die during childbirth.
So a heartbreaking story in the end in particular. And some of the story is based on Ernest Hemingway's own experiences in World War I, right?
That's true, yes. He served as a volunteer ambulance driver for the Red Cross during World War I, and he also fell in love with a nurse by the name of Agnes von Karowski at that time. So some of his own experiences inspired the novel.
Now, do you remember the first time you read A Farewell to Arms?
I first read the book a long time ago during college when I actually had a semester abroad in Italy and I brought it with me. And I really enjoyed it at that time, especially reading it in Italy.
Well, and you must have been thinking, my God, my grandfather wrote this. I don't know, did that have special impact on you?
Well, it did. You know, he's always been a larger-than-life figure in our family, and even though he died before I was born, my dad was his youngest son. My mom also knew him as his secretary in the end of his life. He was a big presence in growing up as this sort of legendary figure, as a writer, even more than as a grandfather.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the peculiarities of A Farewell to Arms is that it turns out that Ernest Hemingway wrote lots of different endings, sort of like he kept trying to get it right. Do you know how many alternative endings there are to this book?
My grandfather famously said in an interview in 1958 with George Plimpton for an article in the Paris Review, George Plimpton asked him about how much rewriting he did, and he said, in A Farewell to Arms, I rewrote the ending 39 times. And working as the editor of this new edition of A Farewell to Arms, I found actually 47 individual endings in my grandfather's papers, which are preserved in the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library as part of the National Archives.
I mean, those numbers, whether we're talking about 47 or 39, are astonishing. He would try to create so many different endings. Do we know why?
It is amazing, and I think it's a testament really to my grandfather as a writer and how hard he worked at his craft to achieve perfection. So it's an extreme example. I think he didn't rewrite most of his things that many times by any stretch, but it's a really good example, and we can actually see, because he preserved those manuscripts, how he went about this process.
Well, and he also wrote later on, I mean, much later after he actually wrote the novel, in his 1948 introduction to A Farewell to Arms, Hemingway said, "The fact that the book was a tragic one did not make me unhappy, since I believed that life was a tragedy and knew it could only have one end." So I guess he was comfortable about leaving us in a pretty dark place at the end.
Yes, that statement sounds almost ironic, given that he rewrote the ending so many times and tried different kinds of endings. It's clear from the manuscripts that he always did know that the ending was going to be a tragic one. What's interesting, I think, in looking at all these endings is to see that, yes, everyone's life ends in death, but how you live your life and how it ends is important.
Now, do you have a favorite among all these different alternative endings?
My favorite, I think, is the so-called live baby ending, because the ending of A Farewell to Arms was partially inspired by the birth of my uncle Patrick, who was born during the time that my grandfather was writing the book. And my grandmother, Pauline Pfeiffer Hemingway, had a very difficult pregnancy with my uncle, which ended in cesarean section. And, of course, my uncle lived, but the drama and the difficulty of that pregnancy and how difficult it must have been for my grandfather there with her at the time played into his ideas for the ending of the book.
Could you read that ending for us, this live baby ending?
Sure. The live baby ending. I could tell about the boy. He did not seem of any importance then, except as trouble, and God knows that I was better about him. Anyway, he does not belong in this story. He starts a new one. It is not fair to start a new story at the end of an old one, but that is the way it happens. There is no end except death, and birth is the only beginning.
So he seems to be giving us a little bit of hope. Okay, the baby does live, but it's still pretty bleak.
Yeah, for him, it didn't seem the right way to end the story with a new story, basically.
Yeah. Now, there's an even darker ending, what has been called the Nada ending. Tell me about this one.
Well, that ending is really, it's almost like an existentialist take on life, basically. And I can read it. It's very short.
Yeah, if you could.
The Nada ending. That is all there is to the story. Catherine died, and you will die, and I will die. And that is all I can promise you. And it seems to me kind of a cop-out of an ending. What's amazing is that that's almost his philosophical ending. But then he goes into all these other endings, and he really, by the final ending, really achieves an extraordinarily poignant and powerful end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that Nada ending, it's sort of like he was channeling his inner Samuel Beckett there.
Yes.
There's no point to anything. There's another ending. It's been called the funeral ending. Could you read that one?
Sure. The funeral ending. After people die, you have to bury them, but you do not have to write about it. You do not have to write about an undertaker, nor all the business of burial. You do not have to write about that day, nor the next night of the day after, and the night after, and the progress from numbness into sorrow, nor all the days after, and all the nights after, for a long time. In writing, you have a certain choice that you do not have in life. You can see him working through, thinking, well, this maybe is a good way to end the book. But then as he writes it, the more he writes it, the more he realizes it's not how he wants to end the book.
Which is so fascinating to actually be able to see all these different versions. I mean, it sort of is like you're being let inside the creative mind of a great writer.
It's amazing. I think it's true that most people have sadly experienced the death of loved ones, and there is all of that horrible reality of the burial and dealing with the remains and everything. But it's not what's important. It's not what you want to focus on.
Now, your grandfather, Ernest Hemingway, also asked his great friend, F. Scott Fitzgerald, to read the book. And Fitzgerald offered his own take on this. And it's worth pointing out they had a very complicated relationship, which probably played into Hemingway's response. But tell me about what Scott Fitzgerald suggested.
Well, Scott Fitzgerald was a great friend of my grandfather and an early mentor of his, and he had sought out his advice when he was writing The Sun Also Rises, his first novel. But he waited until the very end to really consult with him about A Farewell to Arms. And then when he did, Scott wrote him over 10 pages of commentary about the book and suggested a lot of cuts, and he suggested a different ending. He suggested taking one of the most famous passages, what has become one of the most famous passages of the books, about how the world breaks everyone, which Fitzgerald called the most beautiful passage ever written in the English language. And he suggested ending the book with that passage, which comes much earlier in the story, in the novel. And my grandfather actually took to heart this idea because he respected Fitzgerald's opinion. He did write out an ending using that passage, but he didn't like it and he decided against it.
Why didn't he like it?
He had it much earlier in the book. His handwritten comments on Fitzgerald's notes that are preserved in the Kennedy Library were "kiss my ass," E.H. So basically, he decided to follow his gut and his own ideas of how to finish the book.
Well, we should talk about the actual ending, the one that that we all do know, the version that was published. And I'm wondering if you could actually read it. And I'm thinking maybe if you could start with the lines, "I waited outside in the hall."
Sure. "I waited outside in the hall. I waited a long time. The nurse came to the door and came over to me. 'I'm afraid Mrs. Henry is very ill,' she said. 'I'm afraid for her.' 'Is she dead?' 'No, but she is unconscious. It seems she had one hemorrhage after another. They couldn't stop it. I went into the room and stayed with Catherine until she died. She was unconscious all the time, and it did not take her very long to die.' Outside the room, in the hall, I spoke to the doctor. 'Is there anything I can do tonight?' 'No, there is nothing to do. Can I take you to your hotel?' 'No, thank you. I'm going to stay here a while.' 'I know there is nothing to say. I cannot tell you.' 'No,' I said, 'there's nothing to say.' 'Good night,' he said. 'I cannot take you to your hotel?' 'No, thank you.' 'It was the only thing to do,' he said. 'The operation proved—' 'I don't want to talk about it,' I said. 'I would like to take you to your hotel.' 'No, thank you.' He went down the hall. I went to the door of the room. 'You can't come in now,' one of the nurses said. 'Yes, I can,' I said. 'You can't come in yet.' 'You get out,' I said. 'The other one, too.' But after I got them out and shut the door and turned off the light, it wasn't any good. It was like saying goodbye to a statue. After a while, I went out and left the hospital and walked back to the hotel in the rain." The end.
And that really is a wonderful ending, isn't it?
It is. To my mind, it is the finest of all the different endings that he worked on. And you can see even in his manuscripts, which are presented in this new edition, how hard he even worked at that last ending, changing the words to give it the most power and really cutting it down. And it's so much stronger, I think, to end the book there, you know, where he's actually in there with her. I mean, he leaves afterwards, but that moment of realization when he's in there with her as a dead body is just so sad and so real.
Sean Hemingway is the grandson of Ernest Hemingway. He's also the editor of A Farewell to Arms, the Hemingway Library edition. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Alternative Endings. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.